So after that invigorating overview of all things intellectual property, here's some things that have happened probably in the last year or two that it was probably the entire reason that we came up with the idea for this presentation was an update, but it's probably good that we had a refresher just the same. So in 2011, Congress passed the America Invents Act. There were quite a few different things that they wrapped into this, and I'm just going to highlight a couple because a lot of them have to do with fees. Mind you, a lot of patent attorneys are very angry about this because it's just changing the fee structure enough to where strategies that we've advised our clients of for years and years and years are becoming cost prohibitive if you're a smaller company, and other strategies present themselves for smaller companies to really wreak havoc against large companies, and the money dollar figures attached to some of these things don't seem to really bear out. My guess is they're going to revise this as soon as enough patent attorneys start to complain and say this can't be done. But we'll see what happens with that. But one of the big things that they did was that on March 16, 2013, the United States is going to transition from a first-to-invent system to a first-inventor-to-file system. That means, in the United States, we've always recognized that anybody who invents something that comes up with that novel and non-obvious useful thing, whoever actually invented it first is the person who has the rights to it. You typically have to prove that here's my notebook and I kind of thought of it on this day and then I diligently pursued reduction to practice by working on it a little bit every day. I approached my patent attorney, we prepared the application, then we filed. So if you can prove all those things, you get the benefit of all the way back to this very moment in time that you thought of the idea. That's when you have the possession of it, and that's your effective filing date, so to say. The entire rest of the world has a first-to-file system, so they don't care who invented first. All they care about is whoever filed at their patent office in their country first. So if two people are racing to the patent office is kind of the scenario that's there. So the United States came up with this first inventor to file, which is sort of a hybrid of the two, where we still recognize the fact that an inventor needs to invent whatever it is being applied for. Like in other countries, it doesn't matter whether you came up with it. If you saw somebody else come up with it and you just happen to go to the patent office there first, you're the one with the underlying rights now. We don't have that. You still have to be an inventor, but we're not no longer going to recognize any of these activities up to filing. So it kind of simplifies things in that we don't now have some arguments where I invented that in my garage first, and then what did you do the next week, and what did you do the week after that, and you get into these silly arguments sometimes with the patent office saying, I diligently pursued reduction to practice for the entire time from when I thought of it until we filed a patent. How do you really prove that? I don't know. One of those days in there was Christmas. I decided not to do anything on Christmas, and I spent it with my family. Does that mean that your diligence is ruined right on Christmas Day? You can see how silly these arguments can get. Well, those arguments are going away as the country is moving to a first inventor to file. So as long as you are actually an inventor that came up with it and didn't just copy the idea from somebody else, and you're the first one to get to the patent office with it, you're the one that's first in line and you're the one that will be entitled to the rights. Some have criticized that we've always been a country that recognized the small-time garage inventor working on something their whole life. They just don't have the resources available that some big companies do. Others have criticized the other system that small-time inventors that are working something in their garage can really throw a big monkey wrench into a big corporation like an Apple or a Microsoft that are companies that bring a lot of profits to themselves and then by that jobs to the United States and tax revenue and any number of other benefits that these big American companies can kind of derive for everything else around them. There's arguments both ways, but the United States was getting a lot of pressure to go away from this first-to-invent system because pressure from every other country in the world because, I know.
That's no reason to change it.
Well, it is when we agree to be part of the World Trade Organization. we are trying to enforce our copyrights throughout the world because the United States far and away creates more content than any other country. So give a little, take a little is kind of the argument that's there. We recognize everybody else's rights within copyright. We're expecting every other country to recognize our copyrights. So they were kind of, other countries were upset that the United States had some system that people could reach back in time and grab ideas that other people in other countries thought they were the first to do. And it's just, it's kind of butting heads with the law. And everybody has agreed to participate with the World Trade Organization, and specifically the World Intellectual Property Organization. So this brings the United States more in line with that treaty.
Did China sign on to that?
Yes. They've always been that. But China's got other issues, which we won't get into. That's probably the big, most important change out of this. Other things that I've put here, eliminates false marking lawsuits. Recently, there was some attorneys that figured out that they could enrich themselves by suing companies that accidentally let their patent number run too long on the products that they were out there. The idea here is that anybody acting in the public interest could sue an owner of a patent who kept marking their product with the patent after the patent expired. So they called it a false marking lawsuit. So let's take the top of a Starbucks cup that has U.S. patent number on it. I think they used to. Or certainly those little sleeves were under patent. I think they still are. So they manufacture how many at a time, and they all have a little marking on there. Well, then all of a sudden one day patent expires, and they've got a bunch of these that they've already manufactured. They're out there in the marketplace. A few people are grabbing them here and there. They immediately start manufacturing new ones without it, but there's a bunch in the marketplace still out there that are going out the door each day that have the number on there. Well, from that day forward, it's a false marking situation. So attorneys could sue Starbucks for misleading the public with marking falsely some of their no longer patented technologies. And as a result of that, they would get their attorney's fees paid, and then X amount of dollars from the company would go to public fund for this sort of thing. But the first part of that is get the attorney's fees paid. So a lot of attorneys would just look around for this gold mine of all these things that are out there. I found one. I'm going to sue. And I'm working for the next year and a half on this, and it's paid for. And it was just dumb because it really didn't serve any purpose. So they got rid of that and said, the government is the only entity that can now enforce these sorts of things. And if they come across it, they can have companies no longer put these numbers out there to try and falsely mark that they still have a patent, but the attorneys aren't going to be the ones being enriched by it. And I think that's a pretty good thing to put in there. I've had colleagues approach me saying, I don't know anything about litigation, but somebody emailed me this list, and it's just ripe for the picking if you want it. And I said, I don't want it. But some did. It's gone. It also created what we call a micro-entity status. In the past, we've had large entity status and small entity status. A company is a large entity if it employs 500 or more people. Anything other than that, you could be considered small entity. This is important because, generally speaking, the fees at the U.S. Patent Office are cut in half if you're a small entity for almost all things. With micro-entity status, we've gone another level to universities and individuals to have those fees cut down to about a quarter of what they are. So, for example, a filing fee for a U.S. patent application that has under the limit number of claims would be, right now it's, I think, $1,130 for a large entity, so half of that would be half of $1,130. Trust me on that. I did my math. And then micro-entity status is a quarter of that, so we're down into the $200 range, roughly. $250. So we've got that in there now, too. They established a satellite office for the United States Patent and Trademark Office in Detroit. They kind of picked Detroit because a lot of mechanical engineers, a lot of innovation going on in, at least used to be, and they figured there's quite a knowledge base to take advantage of, quite an infrastructure to take advantage of, and to a large extent, some of this was a political choice to say Detroit could really use a boost. So they said, good choice for Detroit to have the first one. They've approved funds for two more. One of the cities on the short list is Seattle. Lots of people in the patent community are organizing efforts to sign petitions and write letters and really try to get a satellite office over here in Seattle.
Was it only in D.C. before? Did you know satellite offices, or already got satellite offices?
The Detroit is the first satellite office. It's a relatively new concept.
It's outside of D.C.
It's outside of D.C. Technically, the patent office is in Alexandria, Virginia, just across the border in Virginia, but you know, for the most part, D.C. But they're talking about Denver as a possibility. San Francisco, Silicon Valley is kind of getting some mention. Think of different places that have a unique perspective on that which is being invented. So Seattle's got some push there with Microsoft, Boeing, Amazon, everything else up here related to that.
But they've got representation.
They're
big. They. Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing. Startups in Silicon Valley.
We'll get startups here, too.
Not that many.
What's the advantage to a local community to be located here?
Don't know.
First to file.
Yeah. When the race to the patent office is a lot closer when it's just... there are some possible advantages. Every now and again, you know, if it's being examined locally, I can go in and just sit down with the examiner and point to figures and say, this is where it's different, and a little bit easier argument to make than when you're back and forth.
I would say, as a micro entity that hasn't made money on patents, the access you get from your attorney able to go in and talk to the examiner on your case, right now the bar is you have to hire a firm that's got a presence in D.C. That means you're now at a pretty big firm. If you have that level of access, it would really help smaller companies.
At the same time, most of the time, if I'm going to argue on the personal level, phone call does the trick too, along with WebEx or a few figures back and forth. I haven't felt the need to try to get one of my clients to pay for me to go to DC,
but
just to be in person.
Had an office here,
I know. I'd probably be more inclined to go in and just talk to the examiner straight up in a meeting. And there could be some advantages to that. If nothing else, good for Seattle just to have another presence, one more reason why other startup companies might want to choose Seattle to start up in. So that's a little bit about the AIA. I'm going to talk a little bit about this Authors Guild versus Google. I briefly mentioned earlier that Google was trying to recreate everything ever and then make it searchable. So they sought to digitally reproduce every book in existence, and snippets would be available to entice people to purchase this book. The Authors Guild sued them, saying that they can't do this without the author's permission. They kind of countered to say, well, there are opt-out provisions, so authors can kind of go in and say, I don't want my book as part of that, so I'm opting out. And they... a lot of arguments back and forth. So they never did really get to argue this in court to where it came to some conclusion that the court said, here's how it's going to be. They came to a settlement where they agreed to have a number of, ways that these different databases of information could be searched. Authors Guild saying that reproducing these snippets is a violation of their copyrights. You know, some of them said that. There was a lot of confusion, really, when it all came down. Google was saying this is fair use, that, look, we're just having a snippet of it. All we're really doing is trying to provide everybody with enough information to say whether or not you want to read the book. It's no different than flipping the book over on the back and reading some of the comments on the back, or even flipping the book open and saying, do I want to buy this book because I read part of chapter 7? Yes and no. The original settlement that they came to, for the most part, with the Authors Guild, said, all right, we'll do this, but we're going to set aside a certain amount of money that Google agreed to pay royalties to the Authors Guild and create this books rights registry, to where anybody could kind of go search through this. The Authors Guild all of a sudden is making a little bit of money simply because the registry has been created. So they sought to mollify the authors themselves by saying, at least we're going to pay for this use now. We at first claimed it was fair use, but now we're going to pay a little bit of money for the little snippet that we're going to create. So sounds good, right? And everybody's happy. The Authors Guild was happy with that, and Google was happy paying $125 million to create this whole repository of information and then have some money go back to the Authors Guild. Well, the court struck it down. After they reached the settlement, the court came in and said, this doesn't represent everybody. So the Authors Guild sued not only for the Authors Guild, but on behalf of every single artist and author that had ever existed. So we've got all these unknown artists out there. And they kind of came down to this concept that's been bugging people for a long time of orphan works. What do you do with stuff that you know was created by somebody, but you can't find that somebody? And that's what the court was interested in, is knowing how do we get a hold of these orphan works people, that Google is going to benefit from using orphan works without ever getting money to the orphan authors. So they're still talking about how to do that. And that's a good question. How do you get money to people that you don't know who they are? And they're not willing to come forward, but they're still needing to be represented. They own the copyright here. And if Authors Guild is saying we're suing on behalf of every author, it necessarily includes the authors that we can't find or even know who they are in the first place. So they kind of created their own argument within their own argument by arguing the way they chose to argue. That was convoluted.
Yeah. Why isn't the burden on the authors to come forward to claim their royalties?
Because of the way the Authors Guild chose to situate themselves with respect to this particular suit. Because if the Authors Guild, like if it was J.K. Rowling and two other authors that decided to sue Google, then they came to a settlement. Well, then we've got a settlement between known entity J.K. Rowling and known entity Google. But the Authors Guild came forward and said, we're suing on behalf of all authors known in existence, known or unknown.
So that would preclude those people from suing later.
Right. And
also,
how
there was no agreement, those orphan authors could sue Google for copyright infringement, which Google doesn't want. So they were trying to protect themselves from $30,000 of
right.
Mm-hmm. Over a couple of million bucks adds up to more cash even than Google has.
So they're still trying to figure out a way through this that satisfies the courts, deals with orphan works, yet still allows Google to build the repository that they're trying to do. You don't have that similar problem with, say, like Amazon, because authors on Amazon choose to put them up and generally agree, I want a snippet of my book available because I want to sell my book. Right? Did you have to sign something?
Just an issue of how much.
The publisher.
Well, the publisher takes care of it. Exactly.
I own the copyright, but they own the promotion. I want them to own the promotion situation. I don't want to have to do it.
Exactly. So then that other situations like that take care of themselves because everybody's interests are aligned. Let's try to sell the book. But for orphan works, maybe they're not trying to sell the book.
At some point, there's a large number of books in fair use land that are outside of copyright, like they're old with the
public domain.
Yeah, that's it. Can you talk to that? Can Google But have all the public domain
works? Yeah, because they're public domain.
Yeah.
To explain that concept further, public domain simply means that there is no person that owns the copyright to it. There may have been at some point, but that's no longer the case, so these particular works are now available for anybody to use, recreate, do something with.
And there's no limitation that says that you can't make money from this.
Right. So you see it all the time where symphonies record Beethoven all the time.
All right.
They get copyright for their performance, but they don't get a recopyright of Beethoven's work to stop right. other people from performing Beethoven.
And Beethoven doesn't get anything.
No.
He gets no residual.
Because no, his great-great-grand.
Because he died just over 75 years ago, at least. Because it's 75 years after you die, is what authorship rights grant you till. So you've got situations where the estate of Roy Orbison, the estate of Elvis, the estate of Michael Jackson are still making money off of those things because it hasn't been that long.
Who's the publisher for orphan works?
Well, that's the definition of an orphan work.
No publisher?
Right.
So where does Google get an orphan work if nobody publishes
it? Library.
Old bookstores.
Yeah.
Orphanage.
There's just things that are out there. Oftentimes, it's not so much a book, because books are hard to publish as an orphan, because somebody made the book, and it's usually not the writer. But this often presents itself with pictures. Lots of people are amateur photographers. Then they don't keep track of their stuff. All that stuff that we put up to Facebook are orphan works, because we kind of just gave it to Facebook. Or if we didn't, whatever we did with it, we put it on our own blog. Somebody else got a hold of it. I didn't put any information on the underlying JPEG about how to get a hold of me. And maybe I got a great picture or something, but can't find me. It's an orphan work.
And Pinterest is big these days along those lines.
Mm-hmm. And Pinterest, all these different groups are going through their user agreements and having to continuously revise them because of all these questions. And you got one group that comes up and says, everybody boycott this. Another group that says, these guys are bad. Boy, it's fun to keep track of. And I can't. So, generally speaking, if somebody says that's bad, I'll say, well, how bad? Define bad. Hard to define bad.
Is blog content, is that by default copyright?
If you created it.
Mm-hmm. To what extent does, say someone posts a really good analysis on their blog, one page of anything, how much would another author have to change of existing published content, let's say that's highly original, to have a copyright on his own that would be a derivative, and then how much does that be changed to be considered completely new work?
Well, when we go back to how substantially similar is it? So I'm going to try to convince 12 people that it's substantially similar or substantially different. What's substantially? I changed a lot of the words to have synonyms, but sentence structure is the same, paragraph structure is the same, even pagination is the same. And I changed a bunch of other little words. Probably not good enough. I added Alan Aardvark at the beginning of my list. That's good enough.
That's good enough, sorry, for the which bar, the first or the second, meaning to have a derivative status or be considered totally new?
I guess I threw it out there as an example that cuts the other way. Here's an example of changing one tiny thing that doesn't seem all that it's meaningless. Alan Aardvark is nobody. But I put it in, and now I have changed your list of phone numbers significantly enough to garner my own copyright in the case of phone numbers in a list in alphabetical order. In the case of an explanation of how the internet works, and I just change a few words to say something slightly different, but generally keep the entire structure the same, then I would argue that there wasn't enough of a substantial change there because there was a lot of expression in the underlying work, whereas over here in the list of phone numbers, very little expression in that list.
I had to struggle with that in my research materials to do the book because I learned stuff from things. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways I got around it is I put a bunch of QR codes in the margins that actually go to the places where I learned it, so I didn't actually have to duplicate it in the book at all, but you still get the full benefit, and people are going to their website, so they get the full benefit of that too. So that was sort of a benefit. Now, Glenn walked in, he wrote a book on Pro Tools, and they probably liked it that you did that. It's not like, because you took all the words out of the menus and you, did you look at their operators, the packing material that came with the product, all the owner's manual, and how much of that did you use?
What owner's manual? You started paraphrasing?
Did you figure it all out yourself, or did you read their materials, or?
Well, certain things you have to use their terminology, otherwise you're hosed. But I wasn't about to make up all new terminology for Pro Tools. But I had to come up with my own outline for the book, because I tend to think a little differently than the folks who wrote the Pro Tools manual, a little more practical terms rather than manual. So I set up my own structure, and then I cross-referenced to the original material. And in some cases, there are probably sentences that are remarkably similar, substantially similar.
Like press play. It records, then press play.
Yeah. When you receive this error,
you're hosed.
That is a technical term.
It's an interesting question that I just thought of. Is what you've done a derivative work? That it doesn't really make any sense without their work of Pro Tools.
Without the software, yeah.
Right. But at the same time, is DigiDesign or Avid going to want to discourage that? It's almost like a fan fiction that we had talked about earlier, that it's still good because if you're creating a book about it, that means that people are buying the software.
But Pro Tools is an object as opposed to a creative work. Or Pro Tools is a thing. It's not an artistic expression.
Pro Tools is a collection of intellectual property that includes underlying copyright to the code. It includes trademarks in some of the things that they've called their stuff, and it probably includes some patentable algorithms in the context of what they're doing with the underlying data. So, all of the above? Yeah.
What about the same case of Google Android? It's alleged that Google Android plagiarized Sun's Java system, now owned by Oracle. And that just went to court recently, where they take lines of code out that look, I mean, I'm not a programmer, but it looks kind of similar. Isn't it the same thing where they're sort of, it's a derivative work in there that they have to license?
Or if they just actually copied the code.
Well, that's what they're alleging.
So they started with A, and they...
A prime.
Just grabbed this and did Control-C, Control-V. That is no different than marking from, I've got the Rolling Stones painted black over here from the point zero in time to 3 seconds in, and Control C, and Control V over into my new song. I have copied that snippet. Even if it's this much of a snippet, I've copied it. So there might, I don't know the case you're talking about, but if what they were doing was taking code that they didn't write. Now, if you take that code, like everybody does that code, so I'll just go over here to my other side and type it in, you're probably good. Kind of like if you like the riff to Paint It Black and you want to put it in the underlying song a little bit, sort of, kind of, you hire a guitarist and a bass player to come in and do it. But you don't just actually Control-C, Control-V it. So that kind of goes back to the underlying right, that I have the exclusive right to reproduce the work. If you recreate the work, that's not reproducing the work in legal terms. So, I don't know what's going to happen with this other thing. My thoughts are with code is sometimes just code. I mean, there's accepted ways of doing it.
Wouldn't they hold it as a trade secret?
Yes, but then it's out there. So with a trade secret, yeah, the decompilation... Wow.
But I think that's a tough question. The Google Android thing is a license issue. It's not actually talking about patents and copyrights. It's more about, do you have to license this? Or
sure.
It's my understanding of what their real argument about is.
Right, licensing the copyright in the code.
More about license than copyright.
But what are you licensing?
There were...
It's the right to use the code.
Yeah, but there was three Java licenses and Google was saying we don't need a license because it's open source. I don't know.
Right. I can't speak intelligently about it because I don't know any of the facts underlying. But I'm guessing it all has to do with who did and did not have a license to the underlying code.
How does open source fit into that?
Open source, by definition, is public domain, kind of, sort of.
Creative Commons licensing, things like that?
Yeah. Creative Commons is a whole different animal. Okay. Creative Commons is kind of people saying, I still have the copyright, but I'm not going to sue you if you use it. Or so I say.
Right. Use it in the way that I tell you.
In the way I tell you can use it. And then there's a lot of ways you can use it, and then there's some other ways you can't.
But I don't have to hire a lawyer in order to tell you that.
Right. Well, you don't have to hire a lawyer anyway. But Creative Commons is a creation of the creative world to just put guys like me out of work for a bit of it. You don't need me. You can just, here's what we all agree to. But there again, there's games you play with that gray area, because that's what it is. They're saying, we agree that this is good and this is bad. Well, what about this one right in the middle of good and bad? Well, now you need me again. Fortunate enough. All right, here's a fun thing coming up for everybody. I didn't even know this until a couple weeks ago when I took a seminar. Termination in 2013. The 1976 Copyright Act had perhaps a little red provision. Did anybody know? I'll be curious to know if anybody knew this. That 35 years after creation, a creator can reclaim the work. So I'm an artist, and I created something prior to 1976 Act coming. Actually, no. After the 1976 Act went into effect in 1978, I created something. But maybe it was the Bee Gees and I was under a record label or contract or something like that, or I was just hitting at the time. So I signed a record deal, and I didn't know what I was doing, so I just signed the record deal, and there I was. Well, this provision says 35 years after you created the work, you have the right to rescind any of those contracts you once entered into. So all of these record labels out there that own these songs that were 1978 on forward, all of a sudden are going to lose them. And all of these different artists can now reclaim their work and do what they want to with them. Who knew that? Glenn knew it.
It's percolated on the phone.
So John Fogerty gets his songs back.
If they were after 1978, which
after.
I think...
Isn't it before?
It's after. Because that's what was changed, is that from that point forward... Here's the idea, is that artists are stupid. And they do stupid things like sign record deals. And they can't be trusted to make decisions in their best interest when they're trying to make a record deal. So we are going to take that responsibility away from them and say, it doesn't matter now, we'll give it back. Maybe I colored that a little bit with my personal opinion.
Yeah, the real example of that is when Disney in the early years signed away Oswald the Lucky Rabbit.
Really?
Yeah. That was before Mickey Mouse, and the rabbit is all black and looks real similar to Mickey, but he was young and didn't know anything about copyright and everything, and some big, you know, movie person, producer, whatever, scammed him.
And if there's any good example of a stupid artist, it's Walt Disney.
Yeah.
No.
Experience.
True. True enough. But that was what they were thinking at the time, that they put this into place to say, 35 years is enough time for a company to have these sorts of things, so we'll just take it back. And I'm pretty sure all those companies knew that this day was coming, and these days are now coming.
And it hasn't been revised by the DMC
nope.
or anything else?
This doesn't apply to works for hire, mind you. Only artists that did something for themselves. So if the Bee Gees were already under contract, one could say that's, depending on how the contract is phrased, they could either be work for hire for this record label, or they could be creating their own stuff that then shuffle the rights right on to the record label.
So what kind of work does it usually apply to then? It would be like a photograph that you just snapped and signed the rights away to, and usually record deals are done as work for hire, right?
It always depends.
Well, the songs aren't written typically as works for hire quite often, unless
right.
you're under a songwriting contract.
The first album
right.
is usually not. The first
right.
collection is done on their own, and then they get the deal, right?
Right. But like I said, if it was a work for hire, and you could show that it was a work for hire, that's not subject to this rule. But if you're an artist, and there were quite a few famous ones that are coming up in 1978, like several of them by the Bee Gees, which is why I brought them up. Practically the entire top 50 of the year was under this rule. So all these songs are about to go back to the underlying artists and away from the record companies. And that might, how many different Bee Gees songs have shown up in other movies here and there, or what have you, all of a sudden all those rights revert over to the Bee Gees and not the record label for songs that are showing up in how many different movies here and there?
And labels are trying to recast all those contracts as work for hire.
They are. They're making that argument. There's a decent argument there that, look, we're the ones that created you. So you're really an employee of us. Maybe. I don't know. Kind of cuts both ways. That'll be an interesting thing to see happen.
And
we're going to see
edge,
some.
Right? So it percolated on from there?
In 2013 is where the very first of these are coming out.
And so 2014 will be 79, right?
Yep.
Etc.
So we're going to, I guarantee, we'll see a case where one of these artists challenges the work for hire classification.
Does the right to reclaim extend to their estates?
Yes.
So every single work. And it's going to be subject to
reclamation
yeah.
after 1978.
Right.
And the artist doesn't have to reclaim the right. If they're getting a decent deal from the label, they can leave it there.
That's
but
true,
not,
yeah.
If it doesn't have any money coming in.
Because you figure if you're going to reclaim it, then all of those previous deals under BMI and ASCAP and publishing and some of these other things need to be renegotiated or refigured out. Who knows? It's all a machination of the underlying contract that was there in the first place.
And who gets the master tapes?
Well,
the artist.
But the tape is owned by the record company.
Because of a deal that was signed under the 1976 Copyright Act that necessarily said it will revert upon reclamation 35 years later.
Okay.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Other interesting things, we're going to go through each of these, but here are the ones we're going to talk about. Get them all? Golan versus Holder in restoration. This is the Peter and the Wolf case. Anybody heard of that? Peter and the Wolf was under copyright, it was still under copyright by the artist. If anybody's Symphony Buff, help me out with the artist. Yeah. So, the curious nature of United States copyright law prior to 1976 was that you had to renew your copyrights. And a lot of other countries were that same way. So, if you didn't renew your copyright, the work fell into the public domain. But what is the public domain? Is it the public domain in the United States or out of the United States? Because other countries didn't have this requirement that you renew your copyright, and the United States got rid of it in 1976 just the same, but there was this whole group of works that were still under copyright in foreign countries but theoretically fell into the public domain in the United States. Peter and the Wolf was one of them. So lots of other artists went out there freely performing, creating the underlying sheet music to Peter and the Wolf. Became a very popular thing for high school bands because it wasn't subject to copyright protection in the United States because they failed to renew. Well, then, in order to play nice with the rest of the world, the United States agreed that we shouldn't have that rule. You know, we we took a lot of these works because of our particular rules and put them into the public domain, even though the artists didn't really know we were going to do that or wasn't quite aware of our laws that were different from their laws. So that being the case, Congress recognized a bit of a hole in what everybody else in the world was kind of saying about our copyright law. And in order to join the Berne Convention parts of the Copyright Act that was passed in roughly 1989, we had to agree to restore these back into copyright protection. So we took a bunch of works that were foreign-created works that were formerly in the public domain in the United States and pulled them right back out of the public domain and restored the copyrights to people. So now we've got an issue with, like, First Amendment rights and free speech, and how can you take something out of the public domain that was once there? I have the absolute right to use something in the public domain. How can you take it away from the public domain after I started using it? A little more background there. So this Golan sued First Amendment grounds, arguing that once a work is in the public domain, the public has this expectation of free use. And this is what happened. And all these different high school bands and symphonies everywhere were copying Peter and the Wolf and using it freely, because it's kind of it's hard to come by pieces to freely use that are in the public domain like that. And what an interesting piece of work to go ahead and use and freely copy and distribute. So the Supreme Court kind of weighed in on this one and said, no, they can pull it right back out of the public domain if they want. And that is within the right of Congress to do that, that they can take things that were once in the public domain and pull them right back out and give rights to previous rights holders.
So if the high school band made a CD and pressed 1,000 of them while it was in the public domain, then it pulled out of the public domain, are they now infringing?
That's a good question. I think no, because they created the work legally at the time.
What if they repressed?
And now you're trying to sell some more. Yeah. It's an interesting question that isn't answered, that is going to take somebody in that situation to argue and sue. Probably won't happen. I think most people just avoid it. We're really not talking about a great number of works here, because if a work was at all valuable in the United States, everybody made sure it was renewed.
Is it a finite list? I mean, is it someplace? Is it in the copyright databases?
I think it's the kind of thing that they probably had an open enrollment type of period that people said, all right, I'll take it. I'll take my ability to restore it. I mean, it took this long for it to get to the Supreme Court to even challenge the rule in the first place.
This long was this last year.
Right. This was decided last year, even though in 1994 is when they restored the rights. And it took that long before somebody decided they were going to. It's not like you're going to make any money off of it. I guess you're trying to argue that I was using something that was free, and I was not making any money off of that free thing, or at least very little.
You were making money off of it.
Right, but who's going to take the argument? Who's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court to prove a point?
It was Holder, the Attorney General?
Yeah. Eric Holder.
I thought it was copyright Holder.
That's his middle name.
Yeah. Was that a close
vote in the Supreme Court?
I don't know. I don't know.
It doesn't seem that it would be logical.
Why should logic apply?
Yeah. Well,
no,
ideological.
Another interesting case. This is the Betty Boop case. Warner Brothers, the X1X Productions. The X1X production purchased promotional materials of The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind. Maybe this isn't the Betty Boop thing. Somewhat similar. I think X1X is also involved in that. Long and short of it, they purchased some materials that were promotional stuff that were roughly 75 years ago that were about to go into the public domain, but they got a hold of them to use the way they wanted to use for a little bit of time. And then these images went into the public domain because the copyright expired. So now that their images were in the public domain, they started altering these images to make them look a little bit like the movie production poster and some other things that resembled scenes from the movie itself, which was still under copyright. So they're kind of taking these characters. They've got some promotional material of maybe Dorothy and the Tin Man and Scarecrow, thinking that they had some sort of underlying copyright to the characters themselves, and then started putting the characters in famous scenes that resembled very closely the actual scenes from Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, and other things like that. So it was kind of the question, what is the copyright that is underlying some kind of character like this? And then at the same time, is this a derivative work? How substantially similar is it? This was kind of an interesting case because they reinforced the protection of these characters. And then now you've got an interesting situation where, like, Mickey Mouse can be copyrighted in perpetuity as long as they keep making new Mickey Mouse cartoons. That perhaps actual images from the very first Mickey Mouse cartoons could enter the public domain, but only those actual images. So that if you slightly alter those images in the public domain, now you've sort of slipped back over into the copyright holder's rights of the character. And that's a really weird thing to get your head around, to say, wait, like, this picture of Mickey Mouse is in the public domain, but if I change this picture of Mickey Mouse just ever so slightly different, well, now I'm invoking the character again, and it's still subject to copyright protection.
Pointing to my product, for instance.
Sure.
Wouldn't that be trademark as opposed to copyright?
Well, there's other issues there, too.
Not necessarily.
They have a trademark in the way Mickey Mouse looks, but then you got to sell something, too. That you have to sell something using Mickey Mouse other than Mickey Mouse himself.
Who was suing who in this? X1X altered the images to resemble scenes from the movies that Warner Brothers held the copyrights on?
Right.
And so Warner Brothers sued X1X?
Yes.
And Warner Brothers won?
And the Warner Brothers won.
Saying that X1X couldn't alter these images.
Right.
These public domain images.
Right.
Okay. So that's the opposite of what you were just saying, isn't it?
Anybody else get that?
No.
Out of my sentences?
Okay.
Because I was trying not to say that.
Okay.
No, what they're saying here is X1X were trying to take images in the public domain. It's sort of, it really doesn't really matter if they purchased these promotional materials that then went copyright expired. That was just kind of some of the underlying facts of the case. So they're just taking something in the public domain, these pictures of something. It's like a picture of Dorothy. And they altered it. They took this picture of Dorothy and put her walking down the Yellow Brick Road along with these other characters that very closely resembled an opening scene to Wizard of Oz. And the movie itself is still under copyright protection that Warner Brothers owns.
And you can't do that.
And they're saying that that is in effect a derivative work because of the characters used and the scene invoked.
Can't do it without paying money to Warner Brothers.
Right.
Or getting permission.
But the interesting question is really not answered here. What they said was what 1X1 did violated Warner Brothers' copyright rights in the movie.
Right.
So let's keep in mind that that was the decision of the case.
Right.
But then what's the takeaway? Have we just vastly expanded the rights of characters to where copyright can live on in perpetuity as long as a company keeps creating something new with the character?
What if they had altered the images so that it didn't resemble scenes from the movies? It had nothing to do with the movies.
Or on the blue dirt mountain trail, not the Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah. What did your product say?
Well, then that's the heart of the question that didn't get answered. And that might be some of that could be something else that's coming down the road. It's like, how far does copyright extension or copyright protection extend to a character? It's like I said, as long as you keep creating something new, is the character protected in perpetuity, let alone the actual expression of this character in something? United States versus ASCAP. That's pretty generic. We all know about public performance rights. Is one of those six rights granted to you from the U.S. Copyright Act, that if you're an owner of a copyright, you have the right to perform the work publicly. More often than not, everybody licenses that to ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, and has one of those three companies enforce it for them. So these three companies go out and get blanket license deals with every venue that's out there, and if anybody's ever been visited by them to say you're performing music here in your venue, you just don't want that visit, because then you're going to get into a contract and pay them money. And I've had clients approach me with that before, saying, we're a laundromat and we're just playing the radio. Yeah, but you're playing the radio in your laundromat. So it's public performance, and that's what it is. You're enticing people to come into your laundromat because you have a warm, inviting environment with music, and it soothes you. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's what we're talking about here with regard to the public performance. So they entered into this publishing compact with these. I just explained that. This was ringtone. Is ringtone a public performance? Because that's an interesting question. If I'm in a big public place and my phone goes off,
it's not soothing.
Have I? It's certainly not soothing. But is my phone performing for all of you? Yes? No? That's kind of an interesting question. It's never been answered.
If you can hear it, it's performing for you?
Or what's public? If it's performing for me in my car, it's not really performing for me.
True.
If I'm in my car, it's private.
Or you have headphones and it rings through your headphones.
Right. Then it's private. So it's clearly not.
What if my phone erupts here?
Right. Are we in a public place? Yes. Is the song being performed where we would recognize it, hear it? Is it subject to this right to where BMI and ASCAP would need to get involved in that?
It's likely to be much less than 30 seconds, even though 30 seconds doesn't really matter, but it's all that sampling business
sure.
of time.
But it's still, is it a public performance, is kind of the underlying question. There's lots of interesting arguments either way. The Second Circuit said, no, it's not. That's what we've decided. It's not. That might not be the end of it, because that's not the Supreme Court. But we'll see. There could be another. The way this kind of works in the federal system is that the Second Circuit said, no, it's not. But if the Ninth Circuit says, yes, it is, which the Ninth Circuit could very well do, because the Ninth Circuit represents California with a whole lot of artists, and the Ninth Circuit always does something that's crazy. So the Second will say no, and the Ninth says yes, and then pretty soon it's time to go to the Supreme Court. So this might not be the end of it.
The interesting thing to me is that that ringtone, the big deal about ringtones is that they are out of the copyrights. They're generating all kinds of income for artists and record labels and stuff. They're used because they're generating income due to their other rights.
Yes.
And to say that this particular right doesn't apply and all those others doesn't is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of cuts a lot of different ways. That how can you really keep track of where your phone rings? That if, like I said, maybe I'm on the subway and it rings, but I still got it going through my headphones. Now we're back to not public.
Yeah.
I like this decision. I hope this stands up, because I think it's just far easier to say it's not a public performance. But who knows?
And that's limited to the public performance rights, not the sale of the ringtone.
So what would happen if it was a public performance? Then Verizon and AT&T and all the other carriers would have to get a BMI, an ASCAP, and CSAC blanket license. And you can imagine what that would cost per year.
But they don't buy the ringtones, and people buy the ringtones.
Sure, but they're the ones providing.
They brought convenience.
Right. all of a sudden they're causing it to play. They're causing it to play because a signal came in alerting you that somebody's trying to get a hold of you. That's complicated.
So I took a snippet of "Why Don't We Do It in the Road" from the Beatles.
Okay.
Turned it into a ringtone and put it on my phone.
Okay.
Am I violating the copyright?
Did you own a copy of that song?
Yeah,
I had a license to reproduce it.
Wait. Maybe. Well, did you... You bought the CD?
Yes.
Then you have a license. Not really a license. Okay. You have... You can recreate as many copies as you want for your own personal use. And if it's on your phone, that's personal use.
Okay.
If you bought it from iTunes, that is different.
Because I buy CDs.
I know. I do too. Because when you buy from iTunes or some of these other services, you're not buying a CD. You're getting a license to use this song in certain ways.
Until they cancel it.
Sure. I mean, that's what you're agreeing to whenever you click on the 57-page thing that says, "I read this and I clearly understand." Even though from the time it's displayed to the time it's clicked is on average about a second and a half.
Evelyn Wood.
We think that's
true.
How would that differ from walking through a crowd whistling, "Why don't we do it in the road?"
It wouldn't. So,
no revenue generated.
They're going to have to, this rights holder, ASCAP, if you have a habit of doing this, the advice is don't let anybody follow you.
Especially the ASCAP person.
In theory, yes, that's a public performance of a song. Yeah. But in reality, I like to use this legal defense sometimes. Come on.
Okay, the happy birthday song. No restaurant sing it the right way because of the copyright. What if the restaurant bar had an ASCAP BMI license for public performance? Would they be exempt from, would they be able to do the real version then?
Yeah. And you find it in the chains, like Red Robin and all these other funny chains that do the funny songs. Because they don't get an ASCAP or BMI license, they typically get streamed music from a service. And they've only purchased the songs that they stream in. So they're going to say, necessarily, I want to create this atmosphere at my Red Robin, and it's only going to include these 27 songs, or whatever. And one of them isn't Happy Birthday, because that usually kicks up the price. And but if you're a venue that has the license, I'm not even sure who it's with, one of the two,
yeah,
not CSAC, then you can do it because you're under license. Arista Records, LimeWire. LimeWire, next generation Napster Grokster, way to share files. LimeWire was again ordered to change its ways. Once again, we had sort of a situation that user A and user B could be put together with each other because user A might have something that user B wants, and then we don't talk about what it is they want.
That was a card order?
Not yet.
Okay.
So they looked at this and said, all right, what's going on here? Little history, Napster got shut down because their business model was, if you are a user of Napster and you agree to have all of your songs uploaded to our servers, then the agreement is that other people can go up to our servers and grab whatever other songs happen to be on those servers. So the first iteration of this whole takeaway was, by and large, all of those songs that were up on Napster servers were put there without permission in the first place. So
yeah,
those were all infringing copies.
Was that true that they uploaded the actual songs, or just pointed to where the songs were?
In Napster's case, they actually uploaded the songs. So that's kind of cut and dry, right? Napster has a whole bunch of songs that are on their server without a license, or somebody put them there. It doesn't matter who put them there. Napster didn't buy them, and they're there. So that is kind of cut and dry. So Grokster comes along and says, well, let's just not put them up on the server then. Let's just have person A and person B upload the title to the song to the server. And then people go to the server and say, I see that person A has this song because there's the title that they have. And now I can go over to their computer and say, I want this. And then they would upload to the server and then write back down to the next person. So for a brief moment in time, that song was up there, but it wasn't living on the server. So they thought, aren't we geniuses? A little pat on the back, we got around it. Grokster got shut down for the same reason. You've got, at least for the fleeting moment in time, there's something up on the computer that Grokster owns, and they're facilitating all of this. And they even brought in some inducement of infringing activity types of claims to say Grokster was really just having everybody get together to agree to have these songs be traded back and forth. So LimeWire thought they would get around that by not talking about the titles of the songs and for the most part just being a way for people to talk to each other. And as long as they talk to each other and communicate without using any of LimeWire's servers for the actual transmission of a song from one person to another, then we'll get around it. So the court here said, well, let's look actually what LimeWire is doing. They found them to say LimeWire was aware of substantial infringement by its users, that they were pretty aware that a lot of people were just using this to trade songs back and forth. They were making efforts to attract people to do this, that they were saying, we're the next Napster, Grokster, what have you. They were found to be enabling the users to infringe. And they were depending on all of this business for their own business model of advertising. And, you know, they kind of knew about all this, and they didn't do anything to mitigate this or stop it from going on, and just continued kind of making money off of the advertisement. Not too much unlike Mega Upload or some of these others that have been in the news recently. And we're kind of back to that same old thing that, sure, they don't have an actual copy of something that is illegal, but they're still enabling user A and user B to get together and do this. So they're inducing infringement of this copyright, and that is starting to become a pretty well-established tenet within the concept of copyright law, that if you're a company that, for the most part, makes your entire business centered around the idea that other people can do illegal trading of copyrighted stuff, and you're going to advertise and make money off of that, that is inducing copyright infringement and will be attacked and shut down. So here's kind of the next shoe to drop, and we'll see where it goes from here, because there's going to be a lot of others. And what's that?
Whack-a-mole.
It's kind of a whack-a-mole at this point, but at the same time, you can always follow the money in the advertising and say, well, we've got to do what you got to do. I guess if you're the content holder, you're always going to want to have, you're still going to want to whack the big moles to some extent. I don't know where this is going, because it's just going to keep happening too. My thoughts are that the underlying technology or the business model of music is just going to change in such a fundamental way that it's hard to say. Maybe music becomes ubiquitous of sorts, that it doesn't really matter what music you're getting. If it's all part of a big repository of music, almost like an ASCAP BMI for all use everywhere, that ASCAP and BMI keeps track of public performances and comes up with a huge big formula that then distributes a bunch of collected money out to people. I wonder if something similar could work on the top level with the actual purchase of music.
Movies and books, too. And movies are more complicated or
right.
Different than... So it's going to be really weird.
It's really weird.
It's also driving into dark rides.
Yeah.
Just carrying dark rides around, yeah.
Sure. But then you got to carry a hard drive around.
Yeah, but they're getting really small.
Files of any nature to the clients or just for storage.
Well, I'm going to presume that if you're transferring music to a client, there's a license to do so. So to say, you're just, I'm not.
There's a public option as well, so it's not just between, inviting two people and just posting up there. I think maybe Upload having that as well. Some people were using it for legitimate use and they want their files back.
Right. So there's always a legitimate use for any of these things. Any file sharing site has lots of legitimate uses. The question is that what happens when people start using them illegitimately? And so much so that a great, great majority of the traffic driven to a site is for illegitimate reasons. But that's the trick, is that technology provides us ways to communicate better, and we like the ability to do that. But then we're kind of trusted to not illegitimately use it for other ways. I don't know. It's kind of a tough question.
I found out today that Bono is an investor in Dropbox, so it's fine.
Bono and Edge both are.
So they probably aren't going to be the.
Describe for me the Dropbox concept. I'm not familiar.
You start an account and you start. There's different levels. There's free. You start out free.
2 gigabytes.
2 gigabytes. And then the more people that you get to sign up, if you share, you drop a song that you just post something, whatever. Drop it on there, you invite this person by based on their email, if they accept it, your storage increases, and then they have an account now, and so on and so forth. And then you can buy, you can pay for.
It's $100 for 50 gigabytes per year. It's $200 for 100 gigabytes per year. And for me, I have the 50 gig version because the clients can have 2 gigs free. So I can invite 25 clients that we're sharing full. Because there are different ways to use this, but it's very useful for the business. If you want to have something persistent, Dropbox is good. You send it is another way. It's more of a single endpoint point. So if someone sends me an unmastered file, I can send it back. I don't want to have it on my machine forever, which is Dropbox really takes up a lot of room.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is SoundCloud, which is sort of like a mixture of YouTube for MP3 files.
I use it as a collaborative tool, so I put files up, somebody can go get them and edit them, and I get their edits.
But isn't there an implied?
You share that file. So
right.
You can put whatever's in that file, and both people.
There's an implied privacy in Dropbox, though. You're only enabling people you want to access that. It's not like a public thing.
There is another option.
But it's an option. Why would you put anything in there? Unless you.
But
because you're the business owners of LimeWire and you're trying to figure out your next business model, which is to use Dropbox publicly.
But are you putting the Beatles on there? Or are you putting?
Well, what I'm saying is, I'm not using it for that. But what's to stop, Dropbox to be the next casualty where most people for Mega Upload were not using it for.
I'm saying like all of these factors. If we start to look at all of these things, like is Dropbox doing what it was intended to do, or all of a sudden are they making efforts to attract infringing users by saying, here's where you can do it now? Or if they start to derive a lot of money off of advertisement because they've got so many free users.
Which there's
just
an A, actually.
Okay.
But Glenn seems to have it.
I think I have a partial answer to this, and I stumbled on it accidentally. I use Dropbox all the time for my class as well. But my son's high school marching band went to Dublin to march in the parade. There was a little snippet of video that I found online, and I wanted to share it with the other parents. I couldn't do Dropbox for 100 people, so I put it in my public box and gave everybody the address. Lo and behold, the next day it showed up on the King 5 website with a direct link to my public Dropbox. Within 24 hours, I exceeded my bandwidth limit, and I got a notice from Dropbox saying, you have to pull this down or you're going to lose your privileges. So there, I think there is an implied responsibility there that they accept that we'll allow a certain amount of traffic of questionable copyrighted material, but after a certain bandwidth is surpassed, they will need to record.
And that's kind of speaks to a mitigation of use and somehow efforts to stop the infringing activity of sorts. And so don't be evil.
Somehow well that works.
All right. we're at 10:15, and I can talk about two more topics. Permission pending. SOPA PIPA. Talked a little bit about what this is. Stop Online Piracy Act and Policing Intellectual Property Act.
And there's a third one now. The Skype, whatever the new
kind
one
of. Well, they're all
the same.
It's so very hard to kind of talk about these because they're always changing. These two went under different revisions. They're all just sitting in. They're kind of all sitting in committee, figuring out what should we do. Should we even do anything? There's arguments flying around every direction, and by every direction I mean all of them. It's complicated. So let's try to get through a little bit of it to better arm ourselves with information about it. SOPA is the House bill. PIPA is the Senate bill. The entire idea here is combating online piracy primarily from foreign-based websites. So think mega upload. What we're trying to do here with these is deal with mega upload based in New Zealand. Is everybody familiar with mega upload? Most people are familiar with mega upload. A website that traffics in copyright infringing stuff and makes a ton of money off of advertising. I've actually never gone. Anybody been to there, used it ever? I can't do anything about it if you want to admit that. Long and short of it is this guy was arrested pretty publicly lately, maybe 2-3 months ago.
I think actually someone delivered a track to me through Mega Upload before. Sorry.
Yeah. So there's lots of ways to use Mega Upload correctly. And not, I shouldn't say correctly, in a non-infringing way. But the long and short of it is a whole bunch of people are using it in infringing ways. And this site was actively promoting people to come here. We're the new Napster, Grokster, whatever. And doing all those things in the previous slide that said shouldn't do that because that cuts against you for this concept of inducing infringement of copyright. But it's a foreign website, so what can you really do about a foreign website? That's kind of the trick because we're one country. We just happen to be one country that produces a great, great majority of the world's content that gets traded. So proponents' arguments for these, that's kind of what we've always been trying to tackle here with regard to copyright law, which is enforcement against these copyrights, against foreign websites. It's every country in the world that it belongs to the World Trade Organization, which is pretty much everything except the Middle East and some countries in South America, have agreed to recognize each other's copyrights in the works of authors and other things through the World Intellectual Property Organization. So at least on some fundamental level, every country is trying to recognize every other country's individual's rights to their copyrights. So if we start with that as a starting point, it stands to reason that every country would want to enforce these sorts of things, but that doesn't always play out. So what they would talk about doing in some of these things is to force search engines to remove links to known domains infringing on copyrights. And you're kind of saying, let's black out that entire domain of megaupload.com. And this would be at the search engine level. It could be at the ISP level. It's kind of, we'll talk about why that's bad when we get to not proponents of the arguments here. But here's what it would be able, this would allow the government of the United States to identify places like Mega Upload and what have you and do something about it from a very high level like the ISP level or a Google search engine type of level. Supporters, not too surprisingly, are all the content owners, obviously, because they're the ones looking to protect their intellectual property rights in all of these things. So the RIAA, CBS, NBC, I thought Pfizer Pharmaceutical and Ford were kind of interesting proponents of this, the National Basketball Association. The SOPA bill in the House was written by, or co-sponsored by Lamar Smith and John Conyers. Republican from Texas, Democrat from Michigan. So there seems to be, it's really not a Republican-Democrat issue here. It just cuts across any number of different political bands, and people are jumping in and out of the fold all the time. It's really kind of hard to nail this down. On the one hand, you're wanting to support U.S. companies. On the other hand, some of those U.S. companies are not only these, but the search engines and the technology leaders like Apple and Microsoft and Google and Wikipedia. So now we've got the detractors are arguing against this. Is we might all remember January 18th as the staged protest by some companies the day the internet went dark. Companies like, if you went to Google on this day, there was a big censored sign across Google. If you went to Wikipedia, and this really pissed me off that day because I needed to get to something. Could you?
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that. Anyway, you go to Wikipedia, and just for one fleeting moment in time, it would jump up there. And I remember just hitting refresh several times to try to read two and three words at a time in this damn sentence. But, you know, they just, as a protest of these bills, said, we're going dark, because this is what it would be like. It could be the Department of Justice could just say Wikipedia is infringing, so we're going to shut down Wikipedia. There's always companies that are going to make that draconian statement, but at the same time, they do have the power to do that if they determine that Wikipedia is an infringing company. Will they do that? I don't know. So they said even beyond that, it threatens free speech and innovation. It has a chilling effect on the whole situation of people coming up with new and interesting ways to share files, like the Dropbox. That if they're going to be accused of this, why would any company ever want to try to invest in something like a Dropbox that could be used in new and interesting ways by people for non-infringing reasons? But I guess if you're squarely up against the Department of Justice and could be shut down just like that, maybe not a good area of business to go into and invest money, because you might not be around. So, yeah, there's a big chilling effect on some of the innovations and some of the other technologies that might come to bear in some of these areas. It also argued that it weakens the safe harbor provisions of the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The safe harbor is a provision that allows, some others might have some more information on this, but the concept here is that if there's infringing stuff up on my website, I can claim kind of a safe harbor by taking it down for a few days or something.
Or that I don't know. First of all, I don't know about
it. I didn't know about it.
If I told about it and I take it down, then I can't be held liable.
Right.
So now what GrooveShark did, for instance, is they said they got these things, they took it down, and they told, hey, put that thing back up in the back channel. So that was
right. So with some of these things, once you get accused of it, you might not know that it's there, but geez, once you're accused of it, you're just accused of it. So if an internet service provider, or even Google for that matter, just says, you know, I don't even want to deal with it. I don't care if you were falsely accused or not. It's not worth my time to figure out whether or not your domain is or is not doing what they say you are, so I'm just going to black you out anyway, and that's that.
And Google owns YouTube, so that would be a place where that would
Yeah. So you can see how accusers could use it in a draconian manner, because the ISPs might not want to get involved in the argument in the first place and just wash their hands of it and say, I'm closing your website because I can't. So that's not such a good solution either. Opponents that are on the other side of these different versions of the legislation being proposed include Google and Facebook and Wikipedia and Ron Paul, ACLU, Nancy Pelosi. Just kind of it cuts across, again, political lines, although I don't know what Ron Paul exactly is.
Yeah.
Sort of. Except where he's Republican.
He's a doctor, Jim.
The worst thing about these things, what I understood, was the DNS capabilities going in and
fidgeting with the very low level bloodstream and nervous system of the internet, and it's not a good place to go. It's like if you want to go in and try and figure out how to make your heart stop just for fun.
They would have that power, but who's to say they don't already?
Yeah, it opens the door everywhere around the world for, say, a Middle Eastern government or someone to shut down a news site in the U.S. that's legitimate.
Sure, but who's to say they don't already? I mean, if we make a law that says you can't do this, who's to say they won't? Anyway, just because a law exists. I mean...
Very nice.
I know, and that's kind of the trick here, is that you put a law in place to say don't do this, and here's the enforcement rights that we have, but will they ever use them in the draconian manners being suggested? They could, but will they?
I don't know. Most laws get abused one time or another, and we just assume not take that chance.
Look at the history, even in the U.S.
Okay. But then the reciprocal then is free for all infringement?
Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, but how do you get there? There are, but how do you enforce any of those laws against a foreign website? Which is what any company would argue for themselves, right?
Yeah, because the almighty dollar is certainly more important than the copyright holder's rights to protect their copyright.
From their perspective.
Right, exactly. Wikipedia, that was a little tougher one because they don't necessarily sell advertising on their site, and so there's no direct correlation. But as with the ACLU and some of the other folks on the list, you know, they're trying to protect any sort of restriction. So the Recording Academy still holds that SOPA and PIPA were valid with regard to piracy protections, but they're going to have to look at a new way to implement some of these protections, and that's probably what we're going to be discussing next week, which is the next iteration of these things. The timing was really unfortunate, and there isn't as much opportunity for the proponents of these two bills to get their word out. They certainly don't have the kind of clout that Wikipedia and Google do per pound.
I heard, I thought I was reading a particular quote, I can't remember who it came from, but somebody along the lines of rights holders, like NBC or CBS or something like that, and their content said that it's very difficult to get your message out when the opponents of your message control the ability to get your message out. So if Google and Facebook and Wikipedia can effectively stop your message from disseminating itself amongst the internet, how do you argue that they shouldn't do that?
They've actually succeeded at what they were saying the other side should do, which is inhibit
the free flow of infringing material. Mm-hmm. Now they're inhibiting the free flow of counter-infringing material.
Free speech.
It's the long and short of it is it's a terribly complicated question. And I don't know where it could possibly go. I mean, you've got two heavily armed, heavily moneyed entities kind of lining up on either side where you've got information technology versus rights holders, and there's a lot of money on either side that is going to argue why it should be this way or that way.
What's content going through the pipe, and what I would hate to see is the pipe being broken because of the content that's going through it. I think the pipe should be protected completely. Just as the mechanical aspects don't break the mechanical function of moving the data, you can, you know, what you do with the data at a higher level, you know, that's up to whoever wants to do it. But if you're going to get down into DNS numbers and trying to mess up routers and have Cisco go in and flip switches down at the low levels, that makes tech people just freak.
Well, there are technologies available now for the FBI to go in and do deep packet inspection for everything that you send down the pipe.
Yeah, there are. Actually, they already are. Yeah.
So this is just a very public way to say, let's go after and make examples of people who are obviously trying to hawk their pirated materials. I think whoever said it before was pretty much right on the money. They already have the capability to shut down whatever component or tributary of the stream that they want to.
I'm not sure that they can shut down DNS.
They don't. Put it this way, they can, but there's no legal mechanism to do so.
I don't think there's a technical way to do it right now.
Because to get around damage is what it was built for.
That's right.
Fields, and they would have to actually make it less secure to implement SOFA. They'd have to actually go in there and take out security measures that have been put in place.
Did anybody see the news story out of China that they think that China implemented some low-level shutdown of an aspect of the internet within China?
During that earthquake, for instance?
I'm not sure when it was.
The internet is really best thought of, in my opinion, as one big intranet. It's not the open internet. Even
right.
In China, they all VPN out to free country, relatively free places like Singapore, to get news. And even Chinese people, if you spend $100, you get a VPN pike out to a relatively free place because everyone knows that it's censored. And blogs have stuff removed by an army of 40,000 censors. If they go through everyone's blogs and stuff that's over the line, it's just somehow automatically erased by Big Brother, and that is happening today.
Okay.
So we don't, that's the concern. This is not a future that looks so good for the U.S. if we go down that road.
Assuming we went all the way down that road.
They have. Because they've gone all the way down that road.
Right, but they started from a different starting place on that road.
They did.
So, I think it'd be very difficult to get all the way down that road in the United States.
Now, there's another thing to look at, too, is that technology continues to be enhanced to the point where, like, quantum computing can take care of going through, wiping out any encryption, for instance, if you get a quantum computer actually working to its full capability. And a lot of the things that were formerly secure don't have that capability. So now technological situations of a lot of the technologies coming up that we don't see, if we take and make the rules on what we know now, is short-sighted in a way because the whole singularity aspect of things are going to be very, very different very, very soon, actually.
I think I'd rather see technology solve it from the content point of view, is that if we can somehow monitor content's use aggregately across movies, the internet, ringtones, everything, and to somehow come up with this BMI ASCAP model of here's how much your contribution to creativity is worth.
A full census per play, right?
Yeah.
Because if that can happen.
If we went that route, then we don't care who's using it where.
Mm-hmm. You actually want to encourage people to use it more if there's an attraction aspect on it.
But that's worldwide government now.
Well, to follow up on your comment about LimeWire, there was a study recently that said that in the demise of LimeWire, all of these streaming services have come to the fore, and that's a situation where you can monitor every stream.
Right.
You're right, exactly. And so it, while it's legal, it's also a much shallower revenue stream.
But longer, longer tail.
Hopefully.
So goes the argument anyway. Yeah. Well, how's that for solving everything? Last topic, because somebody wanted to talk about this. DJ Girl Talk, besides Keisha, who else knows? Handful of people. DJ Girl Talk, fellow named Greg Gillis, does mashups. He's a mashup artist, so he'll take bits and pieces of tons of songs. Other mashup artists might take two or three songs and put them together in one new creation and throw some backbeat onto it, and fun and interesting things, but it's very easily recognized that this is a mashup of song A and B, because there's so many elements of A and so many elements of B inside the song. So by and large, if you're going to try to make some sort of commercial use out of that, you're going to have to get underlying permission from A and B rights holders. And people that do that, by and large, do kind of do that if they're going to put it onto a national selling CD or get it on iTunes or what have you. Greg Gillis here is doing something different, where he's taking numbers in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 songs and mashing them up into one song. And it's just little snippets of bits and pieces of the song here and there. Enough to where you'd recognize it and say, that's something I know. And that's really interesting. I like what he does. But he's necessarily saying, I'm taking such a small portion of everything, it's just fair use. And it's not really recognizable without the rest of the song. And my mashup is so interesting because it's not as recognizable as other people's mashups. But he is necessarily saying, I am Control-C, Control-V, this part of this song over into mine. And I'm doing it 300 times with 300 different songs. So I'm kind of saying to 300 different rights holders out there, I'm stealing your music by copying it directly and putting it in mine, and not going to pay you for it. And I'm not going to ask you permission. And he said that. I added the stealing part because I don't think he's characterizing what he does as stealing. He is characterizing what he does as fair use. Fair use is a defense in copyright law that we've recognized for lots of different reasons. By and large, fair use kind of looks at the amount of the work taken, the nature in which the work has been moved over into some other medium, the nature of the underlying business, the ability of the underlying rights holder to still make money with their thing. So you got all these different factors that go into whether or not something is or is not fair use. So he's saying that all of these factors kind of cut my direction, where I'm only using these things in such small ways that it doesn't affect the underlying sales of Madonna's song just because I use a snippet of it. And it doesn't really affect the overall market for that sort of thing. But at the same time, he's still taking a bit and piece of it. And the nature of the reason why he's using it is to then turn around and make some money, or at least reputation of his own, in doing what he does.
I'm doing, we're working on a project about collages of TV commercials. And I'm planning on taking snippets of speech and putting them together in a really odd manner that completely changes, you know, from one commercial and putting it together with another one. Is that a copyright infringement?
It's exactly what he's doing. Because each of the snippets you're taking really make no sense in and of themselves by themselves. But you put them together in some new and interesting way, but you're necessarily actually copying. It's not like you're getting a new actor to come in and act kind of like they did in the commercial and use their own voice and record the audio in your own way. You're taking a portion of the commercial and putting it into your next thing.
Is it fair use or not?
That's the question. It hasn't been decided.
I'm hoping it's hilarious use.
Oh, okay. So is something that is currently a case?
It's not a case.
Oh, okay.
The New York Times characterized it 2.5 years ago as a lawsuit waiting to happen. their characterization is still correct. Nobody, none of these 300 or so artists per song have chosen to really do anything about it, although they could, because we all know that even taking the tiniest of snippets of a song and putting it into something else without permission is copy. It reproduces that without permission. And
it has been prosecuted.
This has?
No, these other things, just the smallest snippets.
Right.
Been prosecuted.
Exactly. And it's been found to be copyright infringement.
But even using it as scratch has been litigated successfully.
Scratch?
Yeah, in the
turntable.
Using a scratch.
Yeah. No, using taking Michael Jackson's record and scratching on it.
So in other words,
rotating the disc.
Even though it's not recognizable. Is that true?
Yeah.
Even though it's not recognizable, you're using a famous part, you're using a famous segment or phrase of that recording and making noise with it.
Yeah.
Not familiar with that one, but maybe. I can see why.
The interesting thing about this is that if he's using 300, it's like it's easy to argue if you're using 2 or 3, that if you know that this work is really dependent on that snippet. But if you're using 300, you could easily, if someone sues, he could easily say if this segment wasn't in there, it wouldn't make any difference. The work is not dependent on this one thing because there's 299 other ones in there that really make this work.
Sure,
it's exclusively dependent on anything.
On my side of it, that's not the argument I've got to win. I've got to argue that you copied, and then I get $30,000.
Or $150,000 if
you're willing. Uh-huh.
You're up to.
It's definitely
willful. Good answer, Steve.
Is a pretty good law check.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Why
here.
Hasn't ASCAP and BMI weighed in since they have a more global view?
They don't have that right. They have the public performance right.
Ah.
We're talking about the right to reproduction. And that's still held by most likely different record labels.
Where's Harry Fox coming?
Mechanical rights.
That's mechanical cover, it's not a...
This is a YouTube phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the reason why the 300 artists aren't doing it is because he's getting so much recognition from everything that they're getting free publicity. Like, oh, there's Lady Gaga, oh, there's Madonna.
Mm-hmm. And also people like him, so if somebody sues him,
exactly. They're
going to be really pissed off
at him. But so many people want to hear the next big thing from Girl Talk that they're getting free publicity.
Right.
It's when he starts making millions and millions of dollars on a piece that he, you know, licensed to Volkswagen or something, and it gets played on the TV, then people will start to remember. But right now, it's
well, he's brand new.
He's
with
the Dynamite brand.
But then, if I turn around and say, you know, I'm record label B over here, clearing all of my samples on this latest album, and I'm paying decent money out the door to clear my samples, why should I bother? So nobody's suing him because they like him, and he probably doesn't have money. So when he has money, yeah. So the New York Times is a lawsuit waiting to happen, comma, when he has money.
It's in his best interest not to get money.
And he, for that matter, you'll notice on his website, he never sells his CDs. You can get them for free. You download them. He's making his money by appearance fees.
Building his brand.
I agree.
At a later stage of market penetration, when there's awareness, then he goes back, thinks good on that, and then signs a real contract because he'll have the money to pay for it.
Or he goes into original work.
Or goes public performances.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can make money.
He could. Yeah. And that's not a bad route to go.
It's a good strategy.
Probably every DJ in existence goes that route at some one point or another to begin with. That they all use stuff, say, look what I can do. And when they start to have something that they can build upon, and they want to record a song, get some CDs going, they'll go back and clear.
Sponsor a line of headphones.
Or or that.
As far as the DJ, that's really more covered under the license, the BMI or ASCAP license, because it's a live performance.
If it's a live performance.
Yeah. And then fair use, isn't that really more predicated on private personal use or, say, use for the public benefit
or
as
education.
Opposed to commercial?
It's the four-factor test. And so traditional places that have always been fair use would be for educational purposes, for news and noteworthy events, So pictures of the World Trade Centers on fire up to about 2 weeks after that happened were considered news and noteworthy. So they weren't subject to copyright restrictions for the different people that took pictures of these. And then after it fell out of the news, after some undefinable amount of time, those pictures that those individual artists took came back into privately held copyright, or at least the newspapers that are using them are no longer doing it under a fair use situation of trying to disseminate news, but rather maybe a retrospective look back at the day. Now they're trying to sell a book or something. That's different than trying to get people to understand what happened. I've looked at the four factors on this fair use thing, and two of them clearly cut in favor of him, and two of them clearly cut against him. That's why it's an interesting case. And it's just going to take one of these underlying artists to get a wild hair up there, whatever.
Or the rights holder on behalf of the artist who has purchased the rights from it, and the artist may say it's fine, but the rights holder is the one that will press.
Right. And I guess that's what I really mean, the rights holder, the whoever owns the underlying rights can do something about it. But at the same time, free publicity. If you got your song out there, imitation is the best form of flattery, so to say. That if Lady Gaga is getting sampled, then good on you. You get to be Lady Gaga.
That doesn't really the free publicity thing doesn't really work. Because you can't have it both ways. Like peer-to-peer sharing is free publicity too. Everyone's hearing your songs.
I know.
Yeah, that's free publicity.
So in the end, it's all up. A rights holder has the right to do something. They can choose to enforce it or they can choose not to. I do have a watch. I think that's going to be it. So.